Members, we're going to call this meeting to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but we'll move your bill, Madam Speaker, as soon as we get a quorum. But if you just want to present the bill and testify, go ahead.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And actually, my constituent who was with me earlier in the week couldn't be here today. So I think it's just me, other than I don't know if I have any opposition. So that might be a possibility. House File 2600 that is in front of you, members, is a bill that would allow the permission for the City of Minneapolis to put up a engine noise sign on Interstate Highway 394. The reason we need this bill is that interstate highways have typically been prohibited or have been prohibited from having these sorts of signs. State highways are not prohibited from having these signs, and so sometimes you see them around the state when there have been concerns about this particular use of engine braking to slow large trucks down. The issue in this particular area is that it really is a situation where, and I actually live on one side of 394, the constituents who are having the issue live on the other side of 394. And what's happening is that there are noise walls on this portion of the highway. That was an old agreement with MnDOT to try to mitigate the noise. This is an area that often violates federal noise guidelines and has had a lot of issues over the years about how you mitigate that noise. This is a different sort of noise. This is a very large, loud, sometimes a little bit prolonged noise that is becoming more frequent. And it's really a geography situation where the one side of the highway is down below in kind of a low area, protected by a sound wall, doesn't get much of this. The other side, the side where constituents are quite concerned, is actually up on a hillside. And so what's happening is the noise is reverberating within the sound wall and echoing up, and then creating a problem. It's a problem for leaving windows open when sleeping. It's a problem when doing work at home. Many of the folks up on this particular section are at home during the day working, and they have had their sleep disrupted. It's becoming more frequent. They feel like this is a last resort to be allowed to have the sign erected to try to minimize the impacts that are happening. You may hear from others that sometimes these signs actually, in some people's perception, increases the amount of noise, but I think my constituents are now at a point of desperation and want to see if they can get some relief from this excruciating noise that they're hearing, and frankly a noise that comes often between about 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. and then at the end of the day. When the highway is moving slow, it's not a problem. When the highway is free-flowing, it's also not a problem. But as the highway backs up, it becomes a very large problem. And any of you who have driven that section of road know that it is frequently congested around the time of rush hours.
Questions from members? A representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, what effect does this have on the trucking companies? Is it going to create an undue burden on them?
I think that, and I don't know if they are here today, they did not testify in the Transportation Committee when we were in the Transportation Committee. What I would say about that, Urson, is that these signs do exist around the state already. It's just that there has been a long time question about on interstate highways. And some interstate highways have solved this in other ways, and I know we have this perennial issue on 35E. One of the ways that issue is solved on 35E in terms of noise is that the low speed limit on there really makes this not necessary, because a lower speed limit, the truck's moving at a slower speed. So I think the issue here is not that this is meant to be a punishment towards the trucking industry or anything like that. I think that the only concern is certainly does not mean that if there is a safety hazard or if there's an accident about to happen, absolutely, I think that would be found out in the evidence that somebody needed to break for that reason. But I think that speed can be an issue, especially going into that time of congestion. So these do exist around the state. It just happens to be on an interstate highway that they tend not to exist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Speaker. I think the Jake Brake issue was solved by the City of Minneapolis on 35E in another way. City of St. Paul, I'm sorry. And that is through the prohibition of trucks on there. Certainly isn't the speed, Madam Speaker, as I drive it all the time, and 45 miles an hour may be the posted, but it definitely is not the norm. Yeah, when you come in just before you hit West 7th, truck traffic is diverted there. I do have one more question, and in reading the bill, I appreciate the fact that you're not looking at the state to bear the cost of the erection of these signs. But, Madam Speaker, what about the maintenance of the signs? Is it understood and your intent that if a big wind comes up or there's an accident and the sign is knocked down, that the city would pay to re-erect? And I don't think we need an amendment to the bill, but is that the intention of the author?
Madam Chair, Mr. Biskins, how about I make a deal with you? I'll go out and fix it. this, in all seriousness, this sign is likely to be put up on the bridge that I cross every single day to get onto 94. I think that it would be implied that whoever paid for the putting up of the sign would have the responsibility for the put up of the sign should it be knocked down. That's certainly hopefully something we will never have to cross in terms of, I've seen a lot of storms go through the area. They sometimes take down the signs on the top of that bridge, but rarely have I seen a sign damaged that's put on the side of a bridge there.
Representative Biskins, one more question, because Representative Howell would like
it. No more questions, but Madam Chair, Madam Speaker, thank you for that. And you know, legislative intent is important at times, so thank you.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Speaker. I have one of these signs very near to my home, and that noise is very annoying. But what I have is a rumble strip on the shoulder in front of my house, and all the Democrats know where I live. They hit that rumble strip. So maybe later on your bill would be open to an amendment to get rid of the rumble strip. But I think it's a good idea. I think you need to have that. And I would encourage you to have MnDOT always repair and maintain it, because that's what we pay them to do. And I'm not sure the City of Minneapolis would do as fine a job as MnDOT.
Representative Kelleher.
Madam Chair, it's always a fine balance as to who is going to pay in any situation, and I understand that. And so we're trying to work with the department to get this done.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, I'm going to vote for the bill because I know how annoying Jake Brake can be, as I guess that's what we call them in the industry. But any engine brake or transmission, use of transmission or engine to impede forward motion, is it really the noise we're after here or the technique? I guess that's my first question.
Well, I think, Madam Chair and Representative Beard, in terms of the constituents who I'm dealing with, it is the noise,
okay,
because they are really at this point prohibited from doing things like sleeping with the windows open. One of my constituents who testified earlier in the week said that he works at home. He'll often be on client calls, and clients will say, "What the heck was that?" And so he feels, I think it's very much about the noise and not the technique. And I think that, my understanding is there may be some other technology out there, but that's not what we are very much concerned with the noise. And this, like I said, Madam Chair, is an area that has been, ever since the agreement and I will just say, my neighborhood sued the Department of Transportation over the building of 394, and out of that lawsuit really did get some mitigation around sound, never around air pollution or any of those things. And the other thing, of course, you all know is this is a very small stretch of interstate highway. When you really think about this, this is it's the connector.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask is because, yes, I think the noise is a serious quality of life issue anywhere, particularly here, but downshifting in the operation of a truck is very normal, and for all intents and purposes, you are using the engine and transmission to impede forward progress by downshifting to slow down for the chronic slowdown as they, go through the tunnel and all that stuff. If it's noise that we're after, just as this moves along, you may want to think about having a noise thing there, which would catch loud pipes. Of course, it catches a lot of Harley Davidsons and low frequency boom boxes as well. But there may be, and this is what I wanted to know if you had anyone speaking to this from the trucking industry side, is there any new technology coming out that allows the Jake Brake effect without the awful blast noise in the background? That might be changing. And
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, I will contact the truckers. They actually have not come to see me about this. I'm not necessarily inviting a big long meeting, but I think we could have that conversation about what's out there. You did get Representative Dominguez and my attention, though, about low-level boom boxes. We both of our districts, as they border each other, suffer from a little noise pollution on that side of things.
Seeing no further questions, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, with that, I will move that we now have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order, and I will move that House File 2600 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance with the recommendation that it go to transportation funds. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Nate.
Madam Chair and members.
All right, next on the agenda, we have Representative Dabney. I will get House File 1097 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. If the pages could, I've got one last handout I'd ask them to distribute to committee members. Members, House File 1097 simply allows local units of government to define dependents as they choose when it comes to providing benefits to their employees. The letter that is coming around, I found last week in a work-life column in the Wall Street Journal. Some members may be surprised that I actually ever read the Wall Street Journal, but I was last week. And it illustrates the need for this bill very well. Here on the starred letter, you've got a family who has taken in the man's mother, doing the right thing there. She's older. She's never worked outside the home. Doesn't have any income. Doesn't qualify for Social Security. And at this point, doesn't qualify for Medicare. She is a dependent on this family's health, on this family's income taxes. But they're unable through the husband's employer, the son's employer, to access health care benefits. And the private plans that they're able to find cost $500 a month or more. A real burden on this family providing health care for all members of the family. House File 1097 simply allows an answer to that problem for public employees of local units of government in Minnesota by allowing those local units of government to define dependents as they so choose. There's no mandate in this. It would be up to each local government to make the determination. Madam Chair, I do have a brief oral amendment, if I could.
Representative Dabney.
On page 1, line 9, strike the word minor. Additionally, on page 1, line 9, strike the number 18 and insert the number 25. And lastly, on page 1, delete line 10. And what this does, Madam Chair and members, beyond get the bill in the form that I would prefer, it aligns the bill with some of the health care reforms that we passed last year in terms of expanding the availability of coverage for dependent children up to the age of 25.
All right, questions for members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Suggestion of Representative Jackson just for form.
I think on your amendment, you would probably want to place on line 9 a comma after the word you.
Madam Chair, I'll accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right. Let's move for members. All right. Seeing none, I would move that Representative Howe.
I think I have a question.
Okay. Representative Howe.
Representative Dabney.
Is this the amendment, Representative?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not the amendment. I'll wait.
Okay. All right. I would move the oral amendment to get the bill in the state that the author would like it. Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
I am. I have several testifiers with me here today, beginning with Ms. Jennifer O'Rourke from the League of Minnesota.
Okay. Representative House, if you want to ask your question now, or do you want to wait till the end of the testimony?
I think it would help if I asked a question now.
Okay, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, when you changed the wording a little bit, so you have unmarried children under the age of 25. Now, I'm assuming because it doesn't say differently, that child could live pretty much anywhere. The reason I ask this is when I first got elected to this office, I had a daughter who was under the age of 18, and she was covered, and then she went to college. And there was a problem with auto insurance, but then she got married, so obviously she was no longer under my insurance, but I felt somewhat guilty when she was off to college living in another area, having my employer, the state, pay her health care. I'm just wondering, would this cover the child no matter where they are?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, happily I'm not an expert on health insurance, but my understanding is that your daughter in that case would have to be a dependent, and I think it's common practice for dependents of that age to be allowed health care coverage regardless of the geography. If there's someone smarter in the room who can correct me, I'm certainly open to that, but that would be my understanding.
Okay.
All right. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this bill forward and to Madam Chair for hearing the bill. We support the flexibility that this bill allows cities. As you might guess, as local governments, we have recruitment and retainment issues, probably similar to those in state government, and we feel that this bill gives us enough flexibility or some more flexibility to offer our employees with their different family situations moving forward. We have a letter that we prepared last year that I believe has been handed out as well. And I would just point to the fluorescent green documents that you've also been handed. On page 4 or 5 of those handouts, they offer a pretty good listing of all the private sector businesses that are able to allow more flexible benefits in this area, and we'd like to just be a little bit more competitive with some of those in our hiring and retaining employees in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Other testimony?
Yes. There's several other testifiers. Dave Engston from the Minnesota Association of Small Cities.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Dave Engstrom, Minnesota Association of Small Cities. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing it back again this year. Our organization includes about 350 small cities less than 5,000 in Minnesota, mostly rural communities. Our board took a look at this bill last year, endorsed this bill. With the turnover in public service jobs, and we've got a lot of aging employees out in rural Minnesota, the small cities, they need to attract new people, they need to attract talented people, and to them, this gives them the opportunity to offer some enhanced employee benefits, something that will allow them to compete with the private sector and attract talented individuals to the small rural Minnesota communities, and we would appreciate your support of this bill.
All right. Further testimony, Representative Dabney.
Ms. Mary Catherine Ricker from Local 28.
All right. Yep. Please.
St. Paul Federation.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I'm a teacher currently elected as president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers. So thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee, for allowing me to speak and taking some time to explain why House File 1097 is important to me and my local union. In the 21st century, school districts are no longer competing with other school districts for talented employees. We are competing with other industries. And we are competing with those industries for very bright, talented workers. There is also a serious trend in education to recruit teachers out of private sector jobs and into teaching, as well as recruiting talented college graduates. But we're going to need a healthy benefits package, and this bill can make us more competitive and help us recruit the best. I just finished bargaining contracts with 3,600 members. But with this ban in place, I'm not able to sit at that table and bargain on behalf of all of my members. I just want the opportunity to negotiate on behalf of all of my members and ask my school district to include domestic partner benefits in our contract. Right now, with the ban in place, I am not even allowed to ask for that at the bargaining table. As I understand it, this bill would also allow us to expand our health care pool, which is something my union has been working on pretty hard. And it also would allow us to include people like one of my colleagues who lives with her sister, who is an editor of a small magazine, and this small company can't afford to offer her health insurance. And so right now she tries to carry a catastrophic plan when she can't afford it. She loves her work for this small company, but if she were allowed to be on the health care plan of her sister, that would allow her to stay at this small company doing something she really loves to do and not, you know, have that kind of constant tussle of, do I find a job at a larger publishing company, someplace where I can get health insurance, or do I stay in this small company where I really love the work I'm doing? This issue has been brought up by my members for the last 3 years I have been president. So I know it is something my members are looking for, something my members are paying attention to. So I would ask you to please support this bill as one way of allowing us to provide comprehensive access to all of our employees for health insurance. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Batting cleanup, Madam Chair, is Mr. John Thorson from Ask Me.
Please state your name for the record. You go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, Council 5. We represent 43,000 workers in this state, 62 employers of which are local governments, about 21,000 employees, over 100 contracts with these employers. We appreciate the opportunity to sit down and bargain health insurance packages with these employers. We share the burden of cost and the benefit of these when we sit down and do that. And we're looking for opportunities to fit that package to more folks' life situations. And I think we share that interest with a number of employers as well. And we'd appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, that concludes the testimony.
Great. Questions from members? All right, seeing
none,
is there, Representative
Lannan,
go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We could ask counsel, Ms. Dyson, not having these other statute provisions in front of me, what are the criteria for being considered a dependent other than what's in this language before us?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Lannan. If you're referring to the language on line 8, it says notwithstanding section 471.61,
yes,
and that law, the 71 law, it's actually in the subdivision right above it, and defines dependent as spouse, minor, unmarried, children under 19 who are actually dependent on the employee. And it was actually amended, apparently, the cross-reference was apparently then amended a while back to 18.
Madam Chair, I'm familiar with the definition of dependent as it relates to student financial aid, having worked with that for many years. Or independent, and if a student is declared independent, if the student is not claimed as a dependent on the parent's tax form, They can't be classified as a dependent. They would be independent. And so my question here is, for those under the age of 25, under current law, if the parent doesn't claim them as a dependent, could they still be considered a dependent under this language?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I believe that would be correct, because it's saying that dependent, and unmarried children under the age of 25 and others defined by the governmental unit.
So just to make sure I'm clear, that even if someone under the age of 25 is no longer claimed as a dependent for their parents, the local unit of government could still classify them as a dependent with this language.
Ms. Dyson. Madam Chair, I believe that's what it states, but I would want to research it a little bit more to make sure, but I believe that is what it states. Further questions, Representative Lanning?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think that opens up the potential of coverage being extended to a lot of people who are not even claimed as a dependent by their parents. And it seems to me that is a serious concern here with regard to this language.
Representative Dabney, do you have a comment
about that? Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, thank you. Yes. We're leaving this to the local elected officials, and they can define whether it's in negotiations with their employees who are represented by a labor union or in their discussions with exempt employees who they would be negotiating, presumably individual contracts, what the expanse of coverage would be, who would fall under that coverage. So it really, the gist of this is trusting local units of government to be responsible and negotiate dependent coverage as they see fit.
All right. Further questions? Do you want to ask your question now, or do you want to wait until I open it up for the rest of the public testimony?
Is there more public testimony? Because I do have some other questions that maybe can play off other public testimony.
I think that there are at least one in the audience that wants to testify in opposition.
Right.
So
I'll hold for a moment.
Okay, great. All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Tom Pritchett, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we would speak in opposition to this bill. I'd just like to make a couple quick points. First of all, I think the intention, while it's not explicit in the legislation, is there in terms of opening up the door to domestic partnerships that was alluded to by one of the testifiers. And also there's a letter that was handed out, made available from the League of Minnesota Cities by James Miller, who says, quote, "Although not mentioned in the bill by name, the League recognizes that the group most likely to benefit from this expanded definition is domestic partners." So, and our concern there is with, in 2 points. One is I think there's enormous fiscal, as were already mentioned, and social implications. If you have local units of government, cities and towns, counties, creating new benefits, what is going to be the cost to local cities, to local taxpayers, state aid, other things like that? I think obviously taxpayers would be asked to pick up that. And also there are really no limitations. I mean, you could have group partnerships, all sorts of arrangements could be created under these benefits. I think also the issue, if you do create domestic partnerships, you're opening up the door to lawsuits, because same-sex domestic partnerships, because then opposite-sex non-married couples would argue that they are being discriminated against, and I think you've got litigation possibilities. And then finally, the point, the concern is the chaos this injects into the whole issue of family definition, dependent definition. You could have hundreds of schools, towns, counties, and cities coming up with different definitions. You drive up and down, let's say maybe I-35 or 94, you could have, you'd be driving through different jurisdictions with different family definitions, and basically the state then is throwing out any notion of a coherent statewide policy on family definition. And family is critical. It's absolutely critical. We see the breakdown of the family, and that's our concern, is for the state to begin to redefine family is not in the best interest of children. So with that, those are our concerns.
Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, I had some issues with this before you made your changes to line 1.9 and striking 1.10. The state has had a vested interest in defining, I think, order in society since government was formed 8,000 years ago. For our governments over the years to have distilled what started out as a payroll benefit in response after World War II, or during World War II, I think, to wage and price control, remember command and control economy kind of stuff, that's when health insurance began to be offered as a benefit to get around, an end run around a government action that many people thought onerous and that really screwed up the marketplace. It's become customary to have families covered by employers as a benefit to employment, as we've recognized here. However, I'm thinking about the way the insurance market works. Now, you're not an expert, I'm not, but I've had some exposure, because one of the things my wife has done along the way has actually been an insurance rater for United Healthcare in years past. And I'm looking at the effect this is going to have on what this does as an unfunded mandate to society in general. Another societal goal we'll have is this latest notion that everybody is entitled to health care, free, paid for by the government, paid by everybody else, whatever. That's the discussion that's going on. You now have taken unmarried children, and you've taken the limit of 18, which has been customarily understood to be pretty much the legal limit of parental responsibility for what we've largely defined over the years as a family unit, and made it 25. Does that mean that my married kids can come home and live with me, and my employer now has to cover them in the policy? That would be my first question, and there's a couple more that go with this, Madam Chair.
Why don't you lay out your questions, and we'll let Representative Dabney take some notes and facilitate moving this bill along.
Well, this bill may not deserve to move along too quickly, Madam Chair, in my opinion, because this is serious business. I thought this was about options for things like taking care of an elderly grandmother or something and so on, until I got this and realized this is not about benefits for taking care of my grandma or moving my sick uncle back into my house. This is about societal change being engineered right here in this room. This is a big deal. It's a big deal to me, and it's a big deal to a lot of people. Okay, I'm going to give you just a couple questions here on my list. Why did you take unmarried children out? Does that mean now that my son and my grandson can move back into my house because they're having a difficult time? Dependent students under the age of 25, I think that was encouraging us to have our kids go to college and maybe even live with mom and dad. So we forced employers or those who covered insurance to take care of students who were dependent on the employee. Why is that gone? Where does that go? And my last question related to this particular line of questioning, and I think this is as far as I'll push it this morning, is when we deal about rating policies and rating insurance, let's just take my city, for instance, City of Shakopee. Suppose they adopt all this and redefine, as in line 1.11, at their discretion, what it means to bring other people into a family or a group insurance policy. What does that do then to the city of Prior Lake group insurance policy if they decide they don't want to, but they have the same insurance carrier? Or suppose Shakopee has Blue Cross Blue Shield like the state does. What does that do to all of our insurance premiums? How does this rating get assigned? How do the people who actually price insurance policies know what in the world they're dealing with here and know how to assign risk and how to adjust a premium accordingly?
All right. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, first of all, this is not a mandate. You characterize it as one, and it is not. It simply allows local units of government the flexibility and freedom to make decisions that make sense for them as employers and make sense for for their employees. Secondly, the unmarried remains on page 1, line 9. So your concern about married people coming back into the family is, I think, dealt with by that concern. And lastly, I would simply say this strengthens families. Go back to the example that I passed out, had the pages pass out, of an older mother-in-law living with a family but ineligible for any sort of health care insurance. That's a financial burden on that family. It's also an emotional burden on that family. I would say that that couple is doing the right thing by taking in the mother, providing her with support and a place to live, and this strengthens their ability to do that and strengthens family ties.
Representative Beard.
As a societal responsibility, family responsibility, that's another word that oftentimes gets lost in this whole discussion. My family is in the same boat. My little sister and her husband have taken mom and dad in. That's fine. We, as the other six brothers and sisters, share that cost with them. That's great. However, why should my little sister be able to add mom and dad to her group health insurance policy and her employer in Kansas City and spread that cost to the other employees in that pool? That gets back to the risk question I was asking about, the rating question, and how we spread this risk, and where is the moral equivalency or the moral compulsion for me to have the expense of taking care of my mom spread on other employees in the district, in the city, in the business? Because you know, Representative Dad, this is going to the business world in about 10 years. We lead here. That's why this is so important, that this is being done in government first. Excuse me for the cold. But I guess that's just my statement, maybe even in a question. If you could get back to the rating question, that is one we haven't addressed yet, but I think is hugely important.
Representative
Dabney. Madam Chair, Representative Beard, first of all, we don't lead, we lag. And if you look in your packet, there are literally hundreds of Minnesota firms and thousands of firms across the country that already have more expansive definitions of dependent in their health insurance coverage, including large Minnesota employers such as 3M, the Mayo Clinic, AmeriPrize, and others. So we as the public sector are lagging, not leading on this, Representative Beard. I can't answer the rating question, but I can share this experience. I was a teachers union president for 3 terms and was at the negotiating table. And every benefit that we negotiated had a cost attached. And my school board was very sensitive to the cost. I would expect nothing different out of cities, counties, and other local units of government when they sit down to bargain with their employees to have a keen eye on the cost of any changes in benefits.
Representative
Beard. Just one last thing, Madam Chair. On line 1.9, the committee, that was my mistake. I crossed out unmarried instead of minor. So just to be fair, my bad.
All right, thank you. Further questions from members? Seeing none. All right. I just wanted to kind of make a personal statement about this bill. Many of you know that 3.5 years ago, I brought a young man into my home. Dylan has been a wonderful addition. As a state employee, Dylan is allowed to be on my insurance coverage. However, my husband is not allowed to have Dylan on his insurance. So even though Dylan is a part of my family, we are treated differently through health insurance. Now, this bill wouldn't go as far as private employers, which is what my husband currently works for. But members, this is a serious issue. And there are all sorts of families, all sorts of shapes and sizes, sisters who live together, grandparents who take in their grandchildren. And if we don't allow some of these changes in definitions, we are leaving behind a number of families that are trying to do the right thing. And so with that, I would renew my motion that House File 1097 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. There has been a roll call requested, so the clerk will take the roll.
Silstrom.
Aye.
Stumper.
Aye.
Silver.
Aye.
Skelzy.
Aye.
Olson.
No.
Marquardt?
Aye.
Wintrusky?
Aye.
Lanning?
No.
Tunin? House?
No.
Holberg? Houseman?
Yes.
Dominguez?
Yes.
Bissian?
No.
Beard?
No.
The vote is 8 to 5. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Next on the agenda. I don't see Representative Hornstein. Are you here? Yes. Representative Hornstein. All right, Representative Hornstein, I will move that House File 2423 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. House File 2423 is a bill, simple enabling legislation to allow municipalities to enact ordinances that authorize the dogs to accompany persons at outdoor cafes that border a sidewalk. This is a very, very common thing in my district, and I think in many of your own hometowns. And it's very important, to the pet owners. This happens again. It's a common practice, but I think we just need to have cities be able to have the authorization to enact ordinances to, I think, in the case of Minneapolis, allow this practice to take place. So I do have a couple of testifiers here that I'd like to call up.
Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Everyone, my name is Ann Hendrickson.
You could turn the microphone for us as we get on the page. Go ahead.
My name is Ann Hendrickson. I live in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm here to ask for your support in this bill. I own a business called Downtown Dogs. That's a dog care facility downtown Minneapolis. We care for about 150 dogs a day. So, and as you stated, I was honestly a little surprised when this bill came up. It's such a common practice. It never occurred to me that it technically wasn't allowed. And it is a good thing to allow for a number of reasons. The first reason is for the business owners, especially with the economy being what it is. People come out more if they can bring their dogs with them, and it allows the businesses to get more clients and more revenue, which is good for everyone. It's also good for the dogs. The more socialized the dogs are, the better they work in society and the better canine citizens that they are. And that's something that benefits dog owners and non-dog owners alike. So it's something where I see it as an everybody wins. There's no downside, and we would request your support.
Thank you. Further testimony, Representative Hornstein? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Doug Kress. I'm actually Council Member Lisa Goodman. I'm from Policy Aid. Unfortunately, she's not able to be with us today. She asked me to come over and testify on her behalf. My comments will be very, very brief. This is an area that we have been working on very, very heavily as of late. Downtown Minneapolis, as many of you know, which we represent, has seen an increase in the number of residents within the downtown area itself. Our population has been booming. Along with that, we've seen an increased number of animals, specifically dogs. And we're lucky enough to have a variety of businesses, such as the Downtown Dogs, who've been opening up to help support some of those and also provide some amenities. With that, we've been able to open two off-leash dog areas for dogs to play in as well, which is a partnership between a nonprofit organization called Dog Grounds and a variety of neighborhood organizations. Part of this is that we do see an increased number of dogs that are out walking and with their owners, obviously. And we have found that they are trying to participate or patronize some of our establishments throughout Minneapolis. And we've seen an increased number of sidewalk cafes who've been calling us, asking us if they are able to have dogs allowed at their sidewalk cafe. This is not allowing them to come into the building. It's simply on the sidewalk cafe. Unfortunately, due to this state statute, we're not able to grant that. And we're asking for local municipalities to be offered to have an opportunity to opt in to this type of a thing, where they could then enact ordinances for restaurants to opt in on this type of initiative, so that they could allow dogs to come to their outdoor cafes. We ask for your support in this so that we can increase our business in downtown Minneapolis. making more cafes open to a variety of people, and invite all of you to bring your animals with you down to downtown Minneapolis and visit one of our many, over 150 different outdoor cafes sometime this summer.
Thank you for the testimony, Representative Horn.
Madam Chair, that would do it for the ones that are in favor of the bill. I'm not sure if there's some opposition.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, we do have questions on the list. I believe Representative Beard was first. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I'm glad to see you're bringing this bill forward. Being a dog person myself, I'm glad to see you're excluding cats. My question to you is, dogs do sometimes. Will the restaurants be required to provide the little plastic bags, and who's going to be responsible for fixing up what dogs do from time to time?
Thank you. I think that would probably be at the discretion of the individual restaurateur. I don't know if Mr. Kress has any insights on that.
Mr. Kress, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, this is something that's already on the books. We already have ordinances that are related to picking up after their dogs as well.
All right. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To my friend from Minneapolis, I do applaud your steps into the libertarian way of thinking. You're absolutely right. Why does big government... state government need to take it? I notice you're taking baby steps, so my question is, why would any level of government be able to do this, and why shouldn't it be up to the restaurant owners? So I see you don't put a prohibition against municipalities creating ordinances banning it. That'd be my preference, but just a question with the latest food fad that I've read about in the news recently. Is there any intent to eat sushi off of dogs in these restaurants?
Representative Hornstein, I think that might be a real question.
I'll have Mr. Kress respond.
That's okay.
All right. Do you have a real question, Representative
Hornstein?
All right. Representative
Stumper. Representative Hornstein, is this a slippery slope? Is this the kind of legislation where you're going to be coming back next year and with legislation to allow people to take dogs into hardware stores and garage auto repair places? Is this just the start of it, Representative Hornstein?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Trevor. This is the proverbial dog's nose under the tent question. But no, I think this is responding to a very real issue in Minneapolis, and I imagine other communities around the city. And I'm not sure, with respect to my good friend from Jordan, I don't know if it's necessarily a trend in libertarianism, but we will certainly continue our conversations about it.
All right, further questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2423 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion failed. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Biggs. Members, this is an informational hearing. We don't technically have possession of this bill, but I do believe that when we're granting immunity to municipalities, it's something that the committee ought to talk about. So, Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the time of the committee, so we will do our best not to take up too much of your time. House File 3441 allows for municipalities to donate fire equipment. And they have to disclose, work with some organizations here to make sure that, you know, they just have to disclose if there's been any problems with the equipment. But what some people are kind of getting disturbed about, to be an interest of Representative Chumper, is that municipalities are donating equipment to, like, South America and not to rural Minnesota because we don't have the right to. So that essentially is the bill, and I have the chief of Hopkins, Mr. Dale Specker, to answer any questions or concerns that folks may have with the bill.
Well, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. If you have any statements, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Speck, and I'm the fire chief with the city of Hopkins. There's been no claims in Minnesota on this, but there has been in other states. So what we're trying to do with this bill is encourage fire departments in Minnesota to donate to other departments in Minnesota. And we think that this bill will help us be able to do that.
Questions from members? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Biggin, if a municipality were to donate public safety, or if a private sector industry were to donate public safety equipment to a municipality and there was failure, could the municipality hold the private sector donor liable?
Representative Bingham, do you know the answer to that question?
Madam Chairperson, the Biskins, I do not, but I know there's somebody from the League of Minnesota Cities that maybe would know, possibly.
Madam Chair.
Okay, they're here, but they don't know. How about we get an answer to that question before we get on the floor?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Biggin. You know, I like the idea of sharing, all right?
I like sharing too.
Sharing is a good thing,
yeah.
All right? However, it seems like over and over again, you know, we create laws which hold governmental units not liable for things that in the private sector people are liable for. And I think if it's good for the goose, it should be good for the gander. Right? And if we are about sharing public safety equipment in particular, right, then we should look at this going two ways. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Bingham, for bringing this issue to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the test.
All right, Representative Markwart. Representative Markwart moves that House File 3129 be recommended the pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Markwart, this May deadline in the Senate, so it should be just fine.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 3129 is really an extension of a bill I carried last year. It was brought to me by the Minnesota Society of Professional Land Surveyors, a group of 650 public and private surveyors around the state. And last, it deals with Chapter 505, which is cladding requirements. And it's all pretty technical and so forth. And was on the House floor last year and passed into law. I think it's by unanimous in both bodies. I can't remember. But this bill just makes some technical changes. And we certainly could go over some of those changes. But all the groups are on board, county, cities, Bar Association. And so we can certainly go over some of the technical changes, but I ask for your support. And I do have some help here. Need to describe anything.
Are there questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Markwart renews his motion that House File 3129 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative
Markwart. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Is Representative West in the room? Not. Representative Thiessen. Perfect timing. All right. I move that House File 3812 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Thiessen. Hand up.
Amendment.
Oh, amendment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, member. This is legislation. Happens around here, becomes a tragedy that has already occurred. I'm sure many members are aware of the Abigail Taylor circumstance. She was badly injured after sitting on an uncovered drain in a wading pool, and she's was badly injured in that. And so, what this bill is really about is an attempt to. And what that did is it had caused our health department and others to look more closely at our school safety regulations, and this is a bill that attempts to improve our food safety regulations. So we try to avoid this contract in the future as far as we can.
Members, the noise that you're hearing means that someone has their cell phone on that's interfering with the recording system. So if your phone is on, please consider turning it off. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
And so just a brief overview. The main thing that kind of sets the context for this bill is on page 3, starting at line 3.21, and what we're doing is expanding the definition of public pools. Currently, the health department regulates pools that are associated largely with food or lodging establishments, and this would start to cover other public pools that have access, public can access that don't have food related to them. And then within that context, it sets in place an additional new standard, both for new construction and requires some retrofitting of current pools to come up to those standards. And those retrofitting provisions you can see in section 3. So for waiting pools, it will be January 1st, 2010, and in for other pools, it will be the next year, January 1st of the next year. And it leaves people with three options. You can see that one of them is a gravity drain where, like, you're basically like your bathtub works. Another option is a suction drain, but that's big enough so a human body can't cover it and block it. And then the third is to have parallel suction drains, which means that if one is covered, there's another also. So you wouldn't have suction effects going on. If we could offer the A3 amendment.
I would move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the order the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you. We are working and I'm working with some of the other interested parties to continue to kind of work out some of the deals. There are cost issues obviously related to this bill, and we're talking about the best way we can practically implement these regulations consistent with making sure that our pools are safe for people. And I think there might be a few people that wanted to put some information on the record.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack Horner representing Minnesota Multi Housing Association. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Very briefly, first of all, we favor the bill. We are working with the author and with the Department of Health. We appreciate very much the consideration and the meeting and discussions we've had so far. From our perspective, we're trying to find the balance, as we always do, between safety, obviously, and preventing tragedy, and affordable housing. Everything you do, of course, has runs up the cost of providing housing. It runs up the rent for people, and it's very important for us to be able to provide affordable housing. So, like everything, whether it's taxpayers or rental housing, that's the balancing act, obviously, and we're working to achieve that. But we've had meetings, we'll continue to talk, and I just wanted to go on record that this is something that has to be resolved, and I'm confident we're in progress there.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stumper.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, this is statewide, and do you have a rough idea of how many pools we might be talking about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is statewide. The only caveat I would say to that is that to the extent local governments do pool inspections, that would stay in place. So we're not preempting them from doing their work on inspections. Currently, we have about 1,000, the Department of Health, it covers about 1,000 pools. This would add about 700 new pools. Now, many of those pools would already be compliant with the standards, but it would add that number of pools to the inspection world. And there's about 4,000 pools that are actually looked at by local governments today. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that would be, I don't know if that answers your question.
But yes, it does.
Further question, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, on line 316 is the definition of ASME. ANFI standards. Just a quick question. I'm assuming those are the industry standards that everybody who's in the pool business is used to dealing with.
Representative
Thiessen? I see a,
please
for the record,
the
I see a head shake.
They can't hear, not on the record.
Yes, but
Madam Chair, when I nod, you can hear it.
Say your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Langstein, Director of Environmental Health in the Minnesota Department of Health. That's correct, Representative Beard.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative. Okay, further questions from members? Was there anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify for or against this bill? Oh, okay.
Can I clarify one more thing on the record?
Certainly.
The pool operator that has to do the daily inspections, I want to make clear that that is the person that works at the pool and doesn't have to be a licensed pool inspector. Is it? So everybody's clear about that.
Okay, great. Representative Beard, further questions?
Nope, ma'am. I'm fine.
All right. Seeing no further questions, I would renew my motion that House File 3812 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Keeson. Representative West, are you in the room now?
Yes, I am.
All right. You missed your turn almost. I will move that House File 3790 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. Did this meet deadline in the Senate?
Well, your committee administrator is shaking his head no, Madam Chair. I don't know, maybe Mr. Black can help.
If you send it to Governmental Operations, Reform, and Technology and Elections, you're going to have to go through rules because otherwise it's dead as of today.
That's what I've heard, Madam Chair, and that's what we intend to do.
Okay.
This is one of those bills, Madam Chair, that has everyone's agreement after a long and really arduous process, so we suspect that we have a good chance of doing that.
Got it. All right. I would renew my motion. Okay. Representative West, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this is a bill that has been a long time in coming. People may recall the Minnesota Property Electronic Recording Act coming through committees in past years. Everyone trying to work together to make sure that all the stakeholders had their say and we have peace in the valley. And after a long period of time, we finally have that. Everyone agrees on this bill. What happens is this. People may remember when you try to go to record your title after you sell your home or you purchase a home or whatever, it takes a certain amount of time for the county to record it. And in that window of time, which during the boom of property, when property was moving a lot, as long as 3 months in Ramsey County, it took up to 5 or 6 months sometimes, and that causes substantial problems for people if they're trying to draw equity out of their home or do anything else with the title, especially if anything changes. For example, if there's a divorce or you want to sell really quickly, it's a problem. The Electronic Recording Act makes it happen virtually instantaneously, sometimes even as short as 10 seconds. And since we're moving into the digital age, that it's really important that citizens have the opportunity to do that. There are 39 counties in Minnesota that are currently authorized under a pilot project to do this. 30 of them are actually making these electronic transactions. This act takes it from a pilot project to being the mainstream of Minnesota property law. Number one, Article 1 of the bill includes general provisions that integrate, well, four things. They integrate e-filings into the existing real property statute. Number two, it establishes an ongoing real estate commission of stakeholders from the industry to have oversight on this. Number three, it provides the real estate commission will be administratively housed at the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And number four, it provides that the real estate commission will coordinate its efforts with national and commercial standards, which is important when we're moving into digital format. Then, members, Article 2, just make sure.
Representative West, we're not going to make you go through all of these articles here today. We care about county reporter pieces.
Got you.
Committee. So if you could just cut to the chase, we'll be on your way.
Well, why don't I just turn over the testimony, Madam Chair, then to my testifier who can explain the county reporter piece more.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. My name is Joel Beckman. I am the Director of Property Taxation and Records for Dakota County. Dakota County is one of the original five pilots within the state of Minnesota. We, in fact, were the first in the state of Minnesota to electronically record a document in 2003. Since that time, we've done approximately 10,000 electronic document recordings, all under this pilot status. And there have been in excess of 30,000 electronic documents recorded in the state during these pilot programs. The original five pilots were Hennepin County, Dakota County, Roseville County, Renville County, and Lyon County. Now, we intentionally chose both large and small counties to prove that this could be done in outstate Minnesota. This is not just a metropolitan government affair. And of the 39 pilots, 37 of those pilots are non-metro counties. This is not simply a metro issue. This is an important issue, as Representative Lesh stated earlier. During the boom years of 2003 and 2004, even in the technologically advanced counties, it took 12 to 16 weeks to get documents turned around. As we were electronically recording during that period, as Representative Lesh stated, it took 10 seconds to do an electronic document. They would submit at 8 a.m. We do our electronic recording at 9 and 1. By 9:01, their documents were returned to the submitter. We've expanded this into multiple model types, but the other thing that's important for you to realize is out of all of the pilot projects and all of the documents that have been recorded, there's not been one issue with security. These are all digitally wrapped, digital certificates, and they are secured connections that we have with contracted, trusted submitters. It's not an issue regarding security, much as it is in the paper world. Anything can happen between the submitters and the county courthouse in the paper world. This is a secured one-to-one connection. I just want to emphasize that this has been tested, it's tried, it's true, and it's something our customers are screaming for. With that, I'd like to answer any questions.
Questions from members? Representative Kemper.
Yes, I'd like to ask, do you have any sense of the error rate?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, we really don't encompass the error rate that we do in the paper world. During 2003, we saw certain document types rejected at a rate of 50% because of errors in the title industry's rush to get documents done and submitted. With the validation processes in electronic recording, it can't leave the submitter's desktop without being correct. It can't get into the county without being correct. So in the case of electronic documents in a Model 3, we see our error rate less than 0.1%.
Wow.
Impressive.
One additional question. What's the cost to outstate counties, to rural counties? Is it very, to get set up for this? Does it cost a lot?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, the cost varies. I happen to utilize a software vendor in Dakota County that includes the basic electronic recording package within their system. As far as other software vendors, I've seen costs anywhere from $2,000 to $50,000 depending on county size and their anticipated usage. But counties were given the ability to put money away via the recording fees when the technology fund fees were increased, and when the fee bill passed 2 years ago, it was with that in mind that the technology fund was increased so that outstate counties would have the opportunity to save money towards electronic recording and technology improvements.
Representative Schumper.
One quick question. Yes. So are these like real small counties, are they doing it themselves, or are they just hiring a vendor to actually do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, the counties in the state of Minnesota usually rely on one of about four software vendors to provide their tract indexing and imaging systems. Okay. It's these vendors that are developing the capabilities of electronic recording and integrating them within their systems. There are three validated vendors within the state of Minnesota. Four validated vendors within the state of Minnesota who can provide these electronic systems currently. This ongoing commission that's being created via this bill will be able to validate additional systems as they become available within the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Beard.
Thank you. Mr. Beckman, the paper trail. Is there a paper trail that backs this up that works alongside of it so that chain of title and the paperwork that accompanies the property stays complete? This isn't just digital,
it's
a paper hard copy also.
Mr. Beckman.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, in some electronic recording types, such as Model 3, and I'm not going to get into the digital technology of it, in Model 3, XML is submitted to the county, which renders into a document. The only thing you would notice between a Model 3 recorded document and a paper recorded document is you don't see a written signature, you see a digitized signature, or in essence block lettering, just like this tablet. Otherwise it renders itself into a paper document that you could obtain a copy of. There is a trail of the XML that is tracked within each computer, both the receiver and the submitter. and they're all registered with a receipt. In the world of Torrens properties, it is directly noted and memorialized on each certificate of title.
Thank you.
All right, further questions? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3790 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Governmental. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and this goes to your motion. It sounds like there's an agreement that this has to go through rules. Right. Would it not make more sense if we just refer it to rules and save a day on the House floor?
Representative Biskins, I am not certain if it needs to go to rules after it's heard by the Committee on GovOps or before it's heard. Does anybody know? But GovOps has specifically
the question is, it has to go to rules. Should we refer it directly or can we refer it to GovOps?
Are you trying to make deadline? Is that what you're trying to do?
Representative Holberg, this is not going to meet deadline. And so we're hearing it here, and Governmental Operations wants to hear the bill. And they can hear it next week. But in order for it to make it out, it has to go to rules. So I believe that it can go from here to GovOps, and then they would have to post GovOps, go to rules to be aligned.
So in other words, you're trying to, because you're stating it's not making, there's a couple options here, and this happened to me yesterday. You could send it to rules, and then it makes a deadline today, and then they can send it back to GovOps, because GovOps still needs to see it, or the other option is at the tail end, you would send it to GovOps, it doesn't meet deadline, but then it can go to rules, and rules can circumvent the deadline rule.
I think we're going to send it to GovOps because GovOps can hear it on Tuesday. And so if we don't send it there, I don't think we would meet in rules and get it sent there.
Right, Tuesday?
Oh, not on Tuesday. Just maybe next week. So I guess we're going to send it to GovOps. But thank you for that clarification. So I would renew my motion. The House File 3790 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations, Reform, Technology, and Election. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Tilbury. Members, I have had a conversation with Representative Tilbury about his bill, and two pieces of Representative Tilbury's bill we have already heard, and so we're going to delete them out. We have heard Section 1, which is the discharge, which was Representative Simon's bill, which we've already heard this year, and Section 2 is the increasing in the amount of money that the Charter Commission get, which has already been vetoed by the governor. So Representative Tilbury has agreed.
That's correct.
And so my oral amendment, first I should move the bill. I will move that House File 3904 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register, and then I will offer an oral amendment to delete all of Section 1 and all of Section 2, which leaves Section 3, which I believe is the non-controversial provision of this bill. So, and I guess there's a Section 4 as well. All right, so Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I need to vote. You need to vote on
that.
Sorry, Felicia. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion for vote. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Section 3 is real important to the City of Fridley. And in your packet, you should have a letter from Bill Burns stating what the issue is there. And clarifies that pretty well. If you look at that, I do have Ann Higgins here from the League of Minnesota Cities to answer any questions regarding Section 3 and also Section 4.
All right.
Which now we'll look
at. Yes. Ms. Higgins, go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I just want to thank Representative Tilbury on behalf of the League for doing this. Just as a way of background on this issue, the City of Fridley brought this matter to the League, to our Service Delivery Committee, and we looked at it from the context of home rule charter authority in general and viewed this as a change that we think is responsive to what we see as a way in which home rule charter cities can fulfill their obligations. If you look at Section 4, which will be Section 2 of the bill, there is a requirement in state law that cities have to take in hand and maintain and deliver feed, water, and sewer services to their residents. In that regard, we have a problem in some situations which occurred in the city of Fridley, but which can occur in many other cities as well, in which the city was stymied in its efforts to continue to do that, carry out that obligation, by a very small percentage of voters being in a situation where they could cause the city to have repeated special elections to question an ordinance enacting a change to the charter to make it possible for the charter to address current circumstances. The charter in Fridley limited the amount of utility rate increases to an amount so small that they could not address the improvements to that system as the system aged. When it was put on the books years ago, the problem wasn't there, and it wasn't foreseen by the folks who did it, and it didn't happen. And repeatedly, the city came up against it, and eventually did figure out, with the help of attorneys, that the section that we refer to in Section 4 was absolutely a stronger obligation for public health and safety the cities have to maintain, but their charter process left them in harm's way every time this issue came up. We just thought that the city officials would meet with us in the summer to talk about issues that have been brought to us, reviewed the issue, talked about it among themselves, and we went out to the cities themselves and said, here's what we think might make more sense in current circumstances, so this won't happen in the way it occurred in Fridley, and also will still give opportunity for residents, for voters in that city, if they have an objection to the unanimous change to the charter that the council has made by ordinance, they can still have a referendum. It's just more comparable to what we require in other areas of charter change, which is 5% of the voters in the city, or we left in, or 2,000, whichever is left, so that it's more representative. The whole idea of holding a referendum that is more representative of a larger body of people who feel that maybe even with a unanimous action of the council, they want another way to weigh in on the issue. Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3904 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tobert. Representative Carlson. I will move that House File 4004 be re-referred to the committee on taxes without recommendation. Representative Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you. And Trey, I also have a member of the representative of the city official with me. I'll just make a couple of comments. Crystal is seeking legislative approval to develop housing improvement programs funded by available taxes and dollars still beyond the needs of the city housing program. And much of Crystal, like the neighboring community, was built pre-World War II and right after World War II, and we have great need to expand some of those homes to make them more livable in terms of today's families' needs, and also to upgrade many of the homes. That really is throughout the city, but I know you're familiar with the city of Crystal, and we want to keep our housing stock up, if you will, and the bill developing the camp to provide that opportunity. So I'll turn it over to
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Patrick Peters. I'm the Director of Community Development for the beautiful city of Crystal. Very, very briefly, this request before you today is to allow the city of Crystal to take a broader approach, if you will, to housing maintenance and preservation. As Representative Carlson pointed out, the city of Crystal is predominantly post-World War II housing, built in the 25 years immediately following the end of the war. Having said that, then the upshot of that is everything's aging at the same time. The housing stock is very similar throughout the city, Cape Cod and Ramblers, and so the issues that we have are also similar. The 1995 legislation that we're seeking to change here allowed for a housing replacement program, two housing replacement districts, which looked at eliminating the worst of the worst. We have programs in place that do that, and our need now, in the 10 years, the 13 years since that action, has broadened throughout the community because of the age of the housing stock. We see the need citywide. We're trying to address that in many of the activities that our Economic Development Authority in the city do already. But there are some gaps in what we're able to do at this point, such as some major upgrades, providing incentives for people with major upgrades to provide for modern day family needs. We would like to also allow some funds to provide upgrades, capital improvements for our multifamily housing population. So this has grown beyond just a pinpoint approach, if you will, to a parcel, from a parcel-based approach to a citywide approach. And that, in a nutshell, is what the request is all about.
Questions from members? Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, how is, or where does the revenue come that's currently being placed into the housing development account?
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, if I can defer to Mr. Peters to respond to that.
Mr. Peters.
Currently, there is a little bit of increment that's being generated from those five parcels that were replaced in the late 90s. And there is a very modest fund that's being accumulating within those two districts, but it is increments from the redevelopment of five lots.
Further questions, Representative Fiskin?
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, I'm not quite clear on what is going on, and so maybe I'll try and explain myself better. It seems like, as I read the bill, Mr. Peters, that on line 7, we are depositing money into something called a housing development account. Right. My question is, if that account exists, how did revenue get into it in the first place? It seems like your answer was through some other parcels. Is that correct? And you can
Mr. Peters, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, the housing account, the housing development account, would be a new account that would be the recipient of the funds from the existing housing replacement district.
Right.
Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then, members, you know, I know this is going on to taxes, and there is a tax issue here, all right? But there's also a local government issue and a good government issue that is happening here. Right? Should it be the policy of this committee to allow revenue collected for one purpose and a very clear stated purpose to then, by state government fiat, be allowed to be used for other purposes, even if those other purposes are similar? And that's a big question and a road I think we ought to go down very carefully.
Thank you, Representative Fiskin. Representative Carlson, do you have a comment about that?
I think he was correct, Madam Chair. That's probably a good discussion. I'm not sure that this bill is the one to generate that discussion.
Thank you, Representative.
Just ask your
head down to the lowest level. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Carlson, I think this is a very good idea, actually. Brooklyn Center, as you know, is an aging suburb. We are landlocked, as is the city of Crystal, and we aren't necessarily generating a lot of new affordable housing. But what we are trying to do is save the affordable housing that we have. And so this is one tool that Crystal has, and I don't even know if my community has the ability to do this same kind of thing, but I just think that this is one way to save affordable housing without necessarily having to only allow communities that have land to grow to be the ones to do it.
So Madam Chair,
Representative
Fiskin. Madam Chair, to that point, I don't think my arguments were geared towards using the TIF concept, all right, for housing replacement, all right, and if that need to be a new law, all right, to be able to do that, then I could, that would be a whole different discussion. The discussion really centers around collecting revenue for one purpose from your taxpayers, and now using it for other purposes than that stated purpose for which it was collected. That's the issue that I raised here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Biskin. With that, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 4004 be referred to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Thank you.
Representative Portman, I will move that House File 3792 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Is it going to be there somewhere else, Representative Portman?
Representative Carlson, it would go back to his committee. I don't know why it got sent to finance originally, but
okay.
We, since on the floor, we moved it from finance to your committee. I told him I'd bring it back to his committee.
Got it. I will change my motion to recommend that House File 3792 be recommended to pass and be sent to finance. All right. With that, Representative Portman, I believe there's an amendment. Representative Portman, is that your amendment?
Madam Chair, there are three amendments. There's an A1, which is the technical amendment, which I...
We don't... Do we have... No, well, so, yeah, why don't you pass them all out and we can talk about them, and then we won't vote on any of them until members all have them.
Right. And then there's an A2, which I believe Representative Nelson talked to you about.
Yes.
And so maybe your amendment. You're the expert on best value contracting. And then the A3 is also an amendment of mine on behalf of the railroad.
All right.
So, Madam Chair, just to tell you...
And there will be an oral technical amendment from staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to let you know what the bill is about before we go through the amendments, that what the bill does is it transfers the governance authority for North Star Commuter Rail from MnDOT to Metropolitan Council. The reason for doing that is we're getting to the point where we're going to be up and operational. And North Star came into existence through a joint powers board of different local government units. In a joint powers called the North Star Corridor Development Authority. But that entity was involved in the development and the funding of the capital. Now we're getting into the operating part of the line. And Metropolitan Transit is the transit agency in the Twin Cities, and it makes sense that they operate the line and that it then messed in with the bus service and the Hiawatha rail service that they also run.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Governor of Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And I'd like to share with the committee that this initiative is supported by the Governor. It's supported by the Department of Transportation, the Metropolitan Council, and the NCBA that Representative Portman just referred to. I think probably the main reason this bill is before you is because this is the Council's first, jump outside of the metropolitan, the Seven County metropolitan area. And I just wanted to share with the committee that the NCDA and Sherman County, where the line will end outside of the metropolitan area, are in agreement and are supportive of this. Mr. Bill Shriver, who represents them, he's not here right now, but he testified in the transportation committee that they were supportive of this as well. So, happy to answer any questions. I've got Mark Furman here, who is the project director for North Star. You can speak to any technical questions you may have, but we would appreciate your support.
All right. Questions for Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shetton, does this bill, as with all the amendments, give the Met Council the authority to tax outside the Seven County metro area?
But Mr. Shetton.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, it does not.
Further questions from members? All right, let's start with the amendment. Let's start with the A1 amendment. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could let Deborah Dyson explain that amendment. My understanding is that's the one she drafted.
Actually, I was forwarding it on from the transportation analyst, Matt Burris, who drafted it to clarify the provisions. And it looks to just watch it very quickly. Section 1 is deleted where instead of having all new language, it's amending existing language related to MnDOT powers related to commuter rail, and putting the language in there. And then on page 3 of the bill, clarifying language at the end of the portion of the bill that's dealing with the Met Council's authority, but it was intended to be clarification, and it was drafted by the transportation analyst.
All right, I would move the A1 amendment. Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that this isn't North Star specific, so now are we giving Met Council the authority to govern all commuter rail, i.e. if they have it in Duluth or Rochester or...
Mr. Shetman.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a good question. That same question came up in transportation. The type of rail that we'd be talking about with the Duluth line is a different type of service than what the commuter rail line is. And if that were to occur, we would have to speak with MnDOT and come up with a different type of arrangement, because I don't imagine that it's the legislature's intention to give the council jurisdiction all the way up to Duluth. What we're really talking about is commuter rail lines like Rush Line, Red Rock, as Representative Harris tried to go on here, but Dan Patch, you know, somewhere down 40, 50 years from now. It's really for those commuter rail lines that are coming from just outside the metropolitan area and then coming into the metropolitan area.
Is this to the amendment?
Madam Chair?
Representative Holbert.
Yes, it is to the amendment. The A1 amendment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where does it say that in this amendment?
Mr. Shetner.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, it doesn't.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, the proposed Duluth line is passenger rail, which is different than commuter rail. It's being pursued under the Federal Railway Administration, the FRA, not the FTA, which is the Federal Transit Administration, so it's an entirely different animal.
All right, thank you.
Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fortman, is that delineated somewhere? It's, you know, oftentimes in statute terms are defined. Do we have in statute a definition of light rail, of passenger rail, of commuter rail, just so that when future legislators or citizens look at these terms, they know they mean something?
Representative Fortman. Madam Chair, Representative Fiskin. I believe it is defined at 174.01, probably, but the definition is very clear in federal law.
Madam Chair?
Representative Fiskin.
I'm the supporter of the 10th Amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Beard or Representative Beard?
My discussion will be to the bill after we're done amending it, because I want to talk to those things.
Got it. Anyone else have a question to the A1 amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion for bill. All right, next is the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment is my amendment. And members, the reason for the A2 amendment is that on page 2, line 9, there is a different definition than I worked so hard to get on best value. And so my amendment simply says that best value really means the language that I gave it in section 16C. And so that is the gist of the amendment. If people are going to do best value, I want everybody to be doing the same best value and not different. So, any questions from members? Seeing none, all those Representative Beard.
I know that, I think Representative Kalin has a bill making its way through the legislature dealing with some of the bidding procedures and so on that MnDOT was engaged in replacing the 35W bridge and some other issues. How does that affect Chapter 16C.02?
I haven't specifically read Representative Kalin's bill, but I've made it very clear that the department did not use best value. It used something else, and so it is my intent to continue to work to make certain that it isn't my bill that he's messing with.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
Representative Beard.
not necessarily to this amendment, but sort of in a kind of a ricocheting kind of way. I'm paying attention to what you're doing there. I may be on the bill so I can have input to it because it relates to some of the things we did last year within 16C going forward that we think, that I think would clean it up and tighten up the process somewhat. So I'll support this amendment, but I just want the committee to know that there are further discussions out there to prevent what happened on the third budget.
I just, again, want to put it on the record that it was not best value that was exactly used in the 35 bridge. The best value has not been used at all prior to the 35 bridge incident. So don't go cleaning up a lot too much that hasn't even been used much. That's my only request.
Thank you.
So, Representative Hortman, or all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I don't care what's going to say. I like the amendment.
Thank you. All right, next is the A3 amendment. Whose amendment is the A3, Representative Hortman?
Mine.
Okay, Representative Hortman.
Since I'm not on the committee, I would need somebody to move it.
I will move it. You just have to describe it.
What it does is it makes sure that it makes clear that we're not changing the rights of railroad employees that are already governed by the Federal Employers Liability Act and the Railway Labor Act.
All right, questions, Representative Holborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we actually have some redundancy here. If you look at the A1 amendment, page 2, lines 1 through 3, you have the same language.
Madam Chair, that may make this amendment unnecessary. No. If you just give me 1 minute,
okay,
see if we're referring
to
a different section of statute.
We'll just lay over the A3 amendment while you figure that out, and we will move on if that's all right, Representative Hortman. All right. I just want to ask, do you have more to your presentation, Representative Hortman? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Questions from committee members? Representative Holbert.
Madam Chair, if I might, I think that you got the A3 amendment applies to sections 1 through 9, and the A1 amendment is a new section 1. So what might make the most sense is actually to have an additional oral amendment to take the language out of the A1 amendment and then just do the A3 amendment so sections 1 through 9 are covered as opposed to having section 1 covered twice.
Madam Chair, I'm actually thinking that in looking at the A3 that it is an error that it should be subdivisions because it's being added as a subdivision 9 to the Metropolitan Council section that has subdivisions 1 through 8, and so I think it's specific to the Met Council section, and the A1 amendment was amending the MnDOT section.
Okay.
So I think it's actually
not redundant.
I think the correction should be on 1.3 of the A3 amendment to change sections to subdivisions.
Oh,
okay.
That's under subdivision 129.
Yeah, it should be subdivisions 1 to 9, yeah.
Okay, so I would move the amendment, the A3 amendment, to change the word section to subdivision. Is that correct? That's correct. Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And then I would move the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, and now there's an oral amendment from Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, technical amendment on the bill on page 3, line 8, before the period to insert and apply from the counties of Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington. This is boilerplate language that goes with bills that direct the Met Council to do anything, and it
I'll just say it's boilerplate language that it goes with the council bill. Okay. Mr. Denton.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dyson, one question for you. We are, is the council going to be operating the fine and it's going to extend it to Sherman County? Should we ask Sherman County about this or is that not what?
Ms. Dyson. Madam Chair, no. This is actually not substantive language that talks about where things are happening. It has to do with the constitutional requirement that special law state the political, identify the political subdivision or the counties in which it has jurisdiction. And I will say there has been controversy in the past about whether or not there's any need for this kind of boilerplate, but since once we started down the road of putting in the jurisdiction of the Met Council and naming the counties in which it has jurisdiction, it's now always added whether or not it's needed, but the jurisdiction of the Met Council is the 7 metropolitan counties, and so that's what we do, and it's not a substantive restriction.
Okay.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Holbert,
that contributes to why it takes over 300 pages to get rid of the Met Council.
Representative Holbert, Hartman, sorry, I understand the point of the boilerplate language, and we always do it, but I do wonder if when the bill was drafted, if it was an intentional omission because of this issue of operating the line into Fairburn County and not wanting to create a basis for challenging the governance. So what I would like to do is work with Ms. Dyson and the folks who drafted the original bill and figure out, we're going to finance, we're going to stop in finance. If we need to add that,
I would suggest we add it here and then take it off if we do that, because I think that you'd have much more comfort on that side of the table if we add it. Would that be correct, Representative Holbert?
Well, we trust Representative Hartman, but we also like Ms. Dyson's suggestions generally, so.
Okay, we can add it. All right. So I would move that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative
Comfort,
to the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Hartman, as an outstate legislator, I have gotten an earful about the criticism of the Metro Council in the year and a half I've been here. So I'm wondering, why are you conveying this significant amount of what looks like new authority to the Met Council as opposed to creating a separate entity to manage the light rail?
Madam Chair, Representative Hartman, Representative Comfort, the criticism that some members, including me, have for the Metropolitan Council is that it's an unelected board that spends taxpayer dollars. It's also appointed by the governor with terms that are coterminous with the governor. And so our metropolitan governance is related to who's ever the governor at the time. And some of us would prefer an elected council that has a separate vision for the metropolitan area that's independent of whoever's in the governor's office. Metropolitan Transit is a part of Metropolitan Council, but Metropolitan Transit is very highly regarded by most of us in the metropolitan area, with I'm sure notable exceptions, as an agency that is very, very effective at running the Metropolitan Transit system. While I wish that they would advocate for more money and that they would have a long-term vision and aggressively pursue the funds to put that into place, in terms of operating the bus lines and the Hiawatha light rail, they're on performance measures. When you look at how Metropolitan Transit does compared to other transit agencies across the United States, they're really at the top of their game. They're a very, very effective agency.
Representative Stumper.
So this is actually, the actual entity will be Metropolitan Transit running it as far as the Met Council. Okay.
Representative Galvey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And to your point, Representative Trumper, if Representative Hausman were here, she would probably give her governance speech, which she indicates exactly your point, is that as we move into more and more of these transit projects, we will have to probably have a different governance structure in the future because it goes outside of the 7 County metro area in many ways. So.
Thank you.
Representative
Diskin. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Trump's point, as we continue along the path that we are, and the Metropolitan Council's mission continues to creep further and further beyond its original intent, we will soon come to the day where we can just disband the legislature, the executive branch, and we can have an anointed body running all of government in the state of Minnesota.
Got a motion
representative. Oh, Madam Chair. Might be a floor amendment.
Madam Chair, can I withdraw my comment?
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Portman, or maybe to Mr. Chetnin, line 112, the word jumped out at me, is must operate and maintain. The Metropolitan Council must operate and maintain. And I know the overall purpose of the bill is to convey MnDOT's operation of this, or this whole line around North Star to the Metropolitan, but it says in any corridor that's located in Holman Park inside the Metropolitan area, is this now from here on out apparently going to be a Met Council operation? My concern is, and it is going to relate to the section subdivision 6 on 2.25 here in a moment, what if, let's just think fantastically here for a moment, there was a line, a railroad line somewhere, where another entity offered to start and operate commuter rail. Would that preclude this from happening? Would it have to go to the Met Council? Would Met Council have to own and operate? Or could any other railroad entity offer to hold out commuter rail, whether it's subsidized by the government or not? You follow my question?
Mr. Chetnin.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that's a good question. I think if it was defined as a commuter rail line in the metropolitan or by the council, that it would probably have to go through a contract with the council to do that. I mean, that's exactly what subdivision 6 is allowing us to do. And as far as if there was a different entity that was going to propose running a commuter rail line, I mean, personally, I don't think there's that many lines out there that are have that potential, and you know the council's working with the counties on Rush, Vine, Red Rock, maybe Dan Patch. And Southwest Corridor is a light rail line, so that would not apply to it. Or Botanical Boulevard, if I haven't seen a light rail line. So we're only talking about a handful of lines, and if we're talking about what Mr. Holberg said earlier, potentially the loop line, I don't think that would apply to this either. So it's I think it's very doubtful that there would be a railroad that would try to maybe privately try to do commuter rail line. And if it were to publicly happen, the council of the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, recognized by the federal government for any type of federal subsidies that would come to these projects. And it would probably have to go through the council for that reason alone.
Representative Beard.
Follow on in subdivision 6. Let's just suppose that a regional rail authority or another railroad came to the Met Council and said, we can operate commuter rail on our line from here to there for considerable numbers less than what Met Council is operating their line for. Would subdivision 6 allow you to contract for that then? And maybe make up subsidies that are considerably less than what they are on other operating lines at the moment?
Mr. Chetnin.
Madam Chair, if it was you would be able to do that. That's there for that intention. And I mean, I think,
thank you, Madam Chair. That helps me spread this.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3792 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify to finance. Sorry. Let's do that again. I will renew my motion that House File 3792 be recommended to pass and be sent to finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Portman. Representative Johnson, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 2351 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Members, this bill directs that a study be conducted of the impact of legislation at least three states that have been enacted statewide video franchising. And just as background, currently under Minnesota statute 238, companies that provide cable TV are franchised exclusively by municipalities. And this bill that you're looking at, the original one, was originally introduced in 2007 as thought to create a statewide system of franchising cable TV. And during the interim, I spent a good deal of time working with stakeholders in a variety of individual meetings. We also convened a working group, met about three times to look at some of the major issues on this complicated issue. And some of the issues we looked at, for example, were treatment of local franchises, how did be treated if we went to statewide franchising. Franchise fees to municipalities, PEG issues, institutional network or INET, and build-out requirements. And we took time in the stakeholder meetings to review all these issues. Now, in these discussions, many references were made to the dozen or so other states that have adopted statewide franchising, and some of the participants in these meetings argued that statewide franchising has led to increased competition, more access, and lower prices, and then the other side, other participants asserted that the opposite occurred. So the purpose of this study, in essence, is to try to get to the bottom of some of these issues and get some good objective information as to what the real nature is of statewide franchising, if it's a, how it affects these different issues that we were laying out earlier this year.
All right, do you have any testifiers, Representative Johnson?
Nope, just me.
Okay, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, members, the reason we have this bill is, as you know, changing from local government franchising to a statewide franchise would have a significant impact on local units of government. Now that it's a study, I'm much more comfortable with where we were going, but I want to make certain that this committee is at least aware of the significant impact that this could have. So, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I wonder if we can't then also ask this study group to comment back on the whole concept of federalism.
I don't think that would be germane, however. I don't think there's a germaneness rule in the committee. So.
Well, Madam Chair, it is the idea of, you know, is it better to have 50 states with autonomy, or should we just have one big federal government? Yeah.
Further questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious why there isn't a consultation with video providers in your study.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holberg. I suspect they will be consulting with them as well.
Representative Holberg.
I guess I'm just maybe more, skeptical. Thank you. I mean, I think they need to be at the table, and I don't see anywhere in here where they are, and that the study is of three states and what happened in those three states. So I would suggest, as you go further, that you might consider having them at the table as well.
All right, further questions from members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, have you had cities that have requested looking at this option?
Representative Johnson.
I've had cities want to take a look at the whole ball of wax, at the whole picture, and see what the pluses and minuses of it. So, yes.
Well, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that that the cities really need to weigh in on this as to whether they really want to see this authority shifted. And the other question I have, Representative Johnson, do we have any kind of estimate on what it's going to cost to conduct this study?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a formal estimate yet. I spoke with research, and they thought in the neighborhood of $75,000, frankly.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Johnson, as you move forward, you might want to amend this to get me a copy of the report as well. So while it goes to the ranking minority members in the House, majority and minority members of the House and Senate committees with primary jurisdiction over telecommunications, you may want to add also those that have primary jurisdiction over local units of government.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? All right, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2351 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Hoppe, is bill is next, and it's my understanding that Representative... Oh, yes. Great. Representative Lennon, whose bill are you presenting to? FinCEN's bill. You're presenting FinCEN's bill? Okay, that's next. All right. Representative Lanning moves that House File 3657 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. What we're doing in this bill, and we do have Peace in the Valley, the original idea was from my senator, and the library board did not support their original idea. There were a number of meetings. Now the library board is on board, so to speak. And the county's happy. As far as I know, the county employees, the library employees are happy. It won't really change anything. It won't change anything in the day-to-day operations of the library. It's just clarifying the reporting structure. The county board was already doing the financing, and this just kind of straightens the lines of communication, and as I understand it, legally makes them more directly liable. But the county, the library board, will still be in charge of what goes on in the libraries, and it's similar to legislation that was passed in Washington, Hennepin, and I know Scott County did something like it. I don't know if it was exactly the same, and that's it. I'll stand for questions.
All right, questions from members. Hearing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning,
Representative Hoppe, so you're going to have two entities you're going to call library boards now, the way it looks here?
So Representative
Hoppe. Madam Chair and Representative Trumper. Nope, there's already two entities there. This is just clarifying how they report. The library board is already there. The chair of the library board is one of my constituents, and he's signed off on this program. The library board decides what books get purchased, how they use the meeting rooms, how things work at the library. All the employees of the library system are county employees, and so the I think the county board just wanted to have a more direct reporting line because they're funding everything. But there won't be any change in the way things are run at the library.
Further questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 3657 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, Representative Lanning moves that House File 3890 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Finstead got called home for some important business, and so he asked if I would carry the ball for him on this bill. We have a very unusual circumstance in Watonwan County. The whole Soil and Water Conservation District Board resigned, and under existing law, and this was before October 1st, under existing law, the board itself has to name replacements with the vacancy, and they have no members to make appointments. So we've got a situation here where there's no board operating, and unless this law passes, there wouldn't be any board operating until after next fall's election. And this is a very unusual circumstance, and so what this bill would do is to allow the county board on a one-time basis only to be able to make these appointments so that this board can function. And Mr. Chair and members, I have here to testify Ms. Judy Erickson, who represents Soil and Water Conservation District, and she can add more to my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A member of Judy Erickson with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation District, and Representative Lanning summarized the situation very well. At first, when the entire board resigned, the district court was asked to make the appointment, and because there's provisions in statutes for when a supervisor resigns or retires between elections, but there isn't any provision in statute when the entire board resigns. And the district court said that no, they weren't in a position to make the appointment, that the county would have to hold a special election prior to this November's election at an additional cost to the county. So this legislation, the timing is important that we get this passed quickly so that those vacancies can be filled. And it is one-time session law, so it's a short-term fix to a problem.
I'm sure there must be some interesting stories behind this. any questions from committee members?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I want to hear the story.
We all do. So,
seriously, how do you have a whole board resign all at once? What,
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert? Under legislation passed last year, soil and water conservation district supervisors were required to file with the campaign finance disclosure board, similar to what you file. And in lieu of sending that paperwork in, they resigned.
In protest.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bless them.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Erickson, were there any other resignations around the state? You know, just maybe one or two in a board?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, no one else resigned.
Any other questions from committee members? Does anyone in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 3890 be recommended to pass and that be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion to pass.
Motion passed.
Thank you. Representative Lanning, Representative Wexham's bill is the last one on the agenda, and I don't see him here.
He's requested that someone come out and get him a few minutes.
Okay. He did go to get him. He's on his way. Okay. So, members, we're just going to sit here and wait until Representative Wexham gets here. Representative Stumper.
Madam Chair, members, I had a number of calls from the same people on our board in my county protesting this filing requirement, the same as we had in the legislature here. And those people are not happy about that requirement. I tell you that. And perhaps we ought to think about changing that next year. I don't know how it came about, but people are not happy.
Representative Wexham, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Lanning, are you moving Representative Wexham?
Yes.
Representative Lanning moves that House File 2687 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Representative Wexham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that the Environment Finance Committee or Policy Committee?
Policy would like to see it.
Okay. I guess I'll have to talk to them. The deadline's today. Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, thank you for moving this bill, and Madam Chair, thank you for the hearing on this bill. To be brief, but recap where this bill was at. Last year we had an amendment that I think went on in the Finance Committee on a lands bill or something similar on the floor. By the time it came to the floor, it was out, and then on the floor we had an amendment to take it back in, and Representative Dill had said he would do what he can to have a hearing on it, and then it ended up in your committee first, Madam Chair. And what this issue is, members, is really many facets that it applies to, but it's a simple issue from the standpoint of it restricts local zoning decisions to be made on ownership. There's lots of property that is what they call legal non-conforming lots. That is, in their day, they were a legal conforming lot to the city, the county, the zoning requirements. But somewhere through time, those lot sizes have been changed or other requirements have changed, which now if they were being plotted, they would be a different size or a different, meeting different requirements. But they allow those to build, and our statutes allow that. But local zoning, in some cases, restricts the use of those legal non-conforming lots based on ownership. So if you're related to each other, or you own two lots, you can't do what you could do if you own one of the lots and your neighbor across the road or 5 miles down the road owned the other lot. I have a couple constituents that have brought this to my attention. Here today is Steve Hill, who's actually Representative Erdahl and Senator Dill's constituent, who heard about this issue and was able to make it in to testify today. But let me briefly tell you about my constituents. And one of them will not come to testify. He will not give his name out, and there's legal reasons he's decided not to do that, but he's scared of the local zoning authority. And essentially, they're taking his retirement away from him, and my constituent that I'm talking about that brought this to my attention 3-4 years ago. Him and his wife have a house on a lake, and the lot next to them at one point came up for sale. They bought the lot thinking this would be a good investment. The county has rendered it nearly valueless because of their zoning based on ownership and the fact that they're related to each other. They're related to themselves. And so the lot next door is a legal non-conforming lot, and the fact that they own it, they cannot sell it and let somebody else build on it. If they'd have never bought it, person X or anybody else that would have owned it could build on it because it was a legal non-conforming lot. But the fact that they bought it, now their retirement was hinged on this. They can't use that lot as a lot to sell 10, 20, 30 years down the road, and they are soon in retirement age. And so that's where this issue initially came to me. Representative Vanderveer and Representative Dill, I think, is familiar with, and several Representative Howes, others have talked about this. Representative Olson, I know, has members, and so that's where this bill came out of. Representative Broad and several members in northern Minnesota are familiar with this issue. And so others didn't want to carry it, and I said I would take this bill on, and that's the essence of the bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll let Mr. Hill tell you briefly his story. And Madam Chair, we have two handouts. One is a map of Mr. Hill's property that he is not able to now sell the lake lot or the hobby farm separately because they have survey corners that touch. And then the other handout. The other one is a copy of the ordinance in Wright County that is just a sample for you. So with that.
State your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Steve Hill.
You could actually pull the microphone closer to you. We are taping. We want to make sure you get on the record.
Steve Hill. I'm a property owner on Lake Sylvia in Lake County. And this, I'm very interested in this. You've got a copy of Lake County's Ordinance 4043 is what they have, and I can read it. In a group of two or more contiguous lots under the same ownership, if an individual lot has less than 20,000 square feet of area, no lot nor lots may be considered as a separate parcel of land for the purposes of sale or development unless each separated parcel and the remainder contain at least 20,000 square feet of lot area. I don't want to dwell a whole lot on my personal situation, but it kind of addresses it. The maps in our situation are Tract A and Tract B. These two parcels were purchased in the late 60s and early 70s by a husband and wife. So they were under the same ownership at the time that this ordinance went into effect in 1979. because of the fact they share a survey corner point, they are considered contiguous, and the county is not allowing the lakeshore lot, which is over 16,000 feet, to be sold separately, even as a camping lot. I guess my issue is I feel ordinances of this nature violate our constitutional rights to buy and sell real estate in the state of Minnesota. Whether these non-conforming lots of record are buildable or not is a separate issue. The cities and counties have got other guidelines to determine whether or not these lots are buildable. Setbacks for buildings, wells, septic systems, accessibility, and so forth. Restricting people from selling them or conveying them, I don't think it's fair. And actually, if a number of these non-conforming lots would be buildable, if they would probably need minor variances or something, which, if approved, would actually help this economy. And there's a lot of contractors that need a lot of to create quite a bit of new construction and building and more people and so forth.
Thank you. Representative Westrom, are you familiar with how large of a problem this is? I mean, are we talking about, you know, a handful, or would this be hundreds and hundreds of pieces of property that this bill would affect?
Well, Madam Chair, what I know of now, it's still handfuls. However, I do, being the author of the bill, I periodically hear from more people like Mr. Hill and other legislators who have constituents with similar problems. So I can't say for sure, but I'm aware of maybe a dozen that I've heard about so far, maybe 20. Representative Howes, I know, is very familiar with this because it seems to be more of a phenomenon with lakes areas, but it does not specifically just lend itself to lakes areas. But so I don't know the answer other than what I know at this present time.
All right, thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To your question, it does go across the state. As you may recall, we attempted to address this issue when I was chairing the committee, and in my area, I find a handful. I have reports from various locations in the state where this is a problem. One thing that does mitigate the problem, however, is that a lot of people buy the adjoining property because they want to expand their own place, and in that case, it's not a problem. I want to remind the committee, Madam Chair, that I think it was in 2005 when we passed the zero discharge septic system technology bill, which I've been monitoring the progress from that bill, and that technology is out there. If the local units of government, if the basis for doing this is environmental, that's really not an issue anymore, because regardless of the size of the lot, they can contain the waste and process it through a separation technology, and there's absolutely zero pollution discharge. So there's other ways to address the problems that I think have started this issue, and I really believe that there's a strong case to be made that if one can't see the constitutional side of this, there's a huge discriminatory side of this, and on both fronts, I think we've really violated people's rights, and this bill should move forward.
Thank you, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did address this in environment last year or the year before, and I see we have someone here from the DNR, and maybe that could be addressed or maybe mentioned to the committee. I don't think we ever addressed the issue of a corner sharing a contiguous cornerstone. I mean, it was mainly lots that were next door to each other. And I thought that we had passed that, but I think we should have some input from
someone
who knows.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, go ahead. State your name for the record. Please take the mic.
Hi, Madam Chair. Kent Lockett, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And we have DNR's opposed to this bill as it relates to the shoreline impacts. And our concern is over the environmental impact, septic system treatment on very small lots, impervious surface coverage. And this is broader than just shoreline, but our issue is predominantly directed toward shoreline. The cities, counties, townships administer those ordinances, and they're here also to testify. It's a longstanding policy of the state to, over time, gradually eliminate nonconformities. What you're seeing now is you have, there are some examples that I've had where there's thousands of these lots. There's a lot of lakeshore lots that have been platted prior to ordinances being adopted, and they have, 50-foot, 40-foot lot width, where the minimum lot width now under ordinance is 100 feet wide. So you do see combination of adjacent lots to meet the standard. I think Representative Weston was right as far as the sale of the lot. What this bill would end up doing is allow the sale without any disclosure to an owner that they may not be able to build on it. It's too small than the ordinance allows. And while you might solve something for the sellers, the next thing you're going to hear about is from the buyers. In a lot of these prior lots, prior planted lots, it would take 2 to 4 lots to make a conforming plot under today's standards. The county, cities, and townships are administering the ordinances appropriately. We've challenged this when there have been variances issued to allow some of these sales of lots, or the variances to develop these, that's been challenged and upheld by the court. Last session, we were directed to do shoreline rules and to commence that process, which we have done. One of the things that we're going to address in the shoreline rules is how we deal with non-conforming lots. And there are some counties that have already adopted standards under the existing flexibility provisions in the ordinances that allows for development of the lots if they meet a certain size of, like, 75% of the existing ordinance required size. So there are provisions in some ordinances, and we've approved those ordinances to allow for development on some of those lots. This has been a big issue. We've heard it the last few issues. I think the appropriate way to resolve this is dealing through rule amendments. That would have a more consistent process statewide. Right now, there's only a handful of counties that have adopted something less than the minimum standards in the shoreline ordinances. So it is a big issue statewide. Counties have dealt with it, I think, from all corners of the state, because there's a lot of shoreline that was platted prior to the 1970s when we first adopted shoreline ordinances.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lotsmore, I know that there's thousands of small lots. So really, with the issue that this is getting at is the ownership issue. And you didn't really speak to that. I mean, I think that everybody's in good agreement that to this, that we should, work to clean up our lakes and et cetera, et cetera. But just by virtue of the ownership, and I mean this in this particular instance where there's only a little corner, not being able to even sell, can you talk to that a little bit? I mean, because basically rights are being taken away from individuals based on ownership, not on the size of the lot, in that they may be able to do something with this lot if they were a separate owner. So can you talk to the point of the bill a little bit?
Mr. Lockett?
Lockett-Smoke.
I'm sorry?
Lockett-Smoke.
Got it.
Yes, Madam Chairman and Representative Holt. The typical practice is if there's more than one lot in single ownership, that they be combined as much as practical to make a conforming lot. And we've had instances where there's 40 lots in individual ordinance or 40 lots in single ownership, and they wish to create 40 individual non-conforming lots, where it's very clear that they could combine those and make you know, 10, 12, 15, whatever the number would be, of conforming lots and meet the standards. Where the issue is mostly heard, I think, is where somebody has bought an adjacent lot for potential investment purposes or future sale, and then are ultimately restricted. And actually, there's a case right now that's in the Court of Appeals over that very issue. The and I think it gets down to what is the size of those lots. If there's two 100-foot lots and the standard is 150 feet versus, you know, how close are they? If they can get to the 75% lot size with each lot, there are counties, and we have approved ordinance amendments to allow for the development of that. But the point is, there are some that are too small, and this doesn't distinguish or have any standards. We met during the interim to discuss how could we address this and have some actual standards to apply to the sale. And while we didn't bring that to a bill this session, that is one of the things that we're going to incorporate into our rule discussion on shoreland rules. So the bottom line is there are some of these lots that are just plain too small. They're 5,000 square feet, 6,000 square feet, versus a standard of 20,000 square feet. If it's 19,000 square feet, you know, the city or local government could deal with that. On this specific instance on Wright County, where it's just a corner touching, I haven't seen it, I don't have a copy of that, but that seems like it's, you know, there may be a way to address that. I'm not sure what the underlying lot size is. Did you say 16,000? And, you know, that's about 75% of the minimum lot width. So one of the things that we have in the shoreland standards, though, and the our standards are a minimum statewide standard, and local government has the ability to be more restrictive if they desire. And through the rule process, we will deal with a standard that in the rule, and if we go that route, that may... Well, you still have the possibility of a local government being more restrictive.
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, but, you know, I mean, I heard the gentleman testify that he wasn't even allowed to sell that property for a tent lot, I think he called it, a camping lot or whatever. I mean, for me, I understand the issue of the conformity and the sewer and, you know, the setbacks and all those kinds of issues, but... It seems to me that there should be some ability for a landowner to be able to sell property, even if but the ability for the local unit of government to still put some constraints on the use, i.e. if it doesn't meet the standard across the rest, you know. And I don't understand why he can't sell that for a tent lot if anybody else could buy a tent lot that big. I don't get it.
Representative West.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, you've hit the nail right on the head. Because if it was Joe Johnson, for instance, this phantom third person that owned that lot, and it wasn't the same owner through the track history or the abstract of the two parcels, that lot would still be allowed to be transferred and sold. It would still be allowed to be built on if they met current zoning requirements. It's only because the same ownership of the two adjacent lots that this lot can't be sold anymore or built or done anything with. And so it would be a legal non-conforming lot, but if it was a different party, they would have to comply with local building ordinances, et cetera, but they could do that. And so you have hit the nail right on the head.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Westrom, I would dispute your interpretation of that. Just looking at this page with the local zoning ordinance, it seems to me that in, you know, note above there, the Board of Adjustment can approve this smaller lot, can give a variance for a smaller lot. And number three there, the point, the item emphasized with the dash marks, it's quite clear that if you combine the two lots and the average of the two lots was greater than 20,000 feet, you could then divide them and sell them each separately as individual lots. That's what number three says. And if that doesn't work, you still have the option of the Board of Adjustment granting a variance for a lot smaller than 20,000 feet above. So I think the emphasis on the ownership is really only secondary. They're just simply saying that if it happens to turn out that somebody owns some lots next to each other, rather than having lots less than 20,000 feet, they'd like them reconfigured so that they would average at least 20,000 or more square feet, and then people can sell them. And that's how it reads here.
Representative Semper, how would you reconfigure these to meet that?
I'd like to ask, have the people in question that Representative Westrom have been bringing forward as testifiers gone through the process of appealing or gone through the process that you have in place?
Madam Chair, I know in previous testimony in the city, some individuals had and some had not. Some had not exhausted all of their local or administrative remedies. Some may have. This situation, Lake Sylvia, that we have here is really much more unique in this issue than what we typically see. Typically, we see the 40-foot lot all along the shore, and many of them are in common ownership, and this is somewhat unique. I think if you took part of Track A and made it part of Track B with a formal subdivision and made it larger than the 20,000 square feet, that would meet that criteria. I'm not sure if this meets the width criteria and some of those other things.
Would you commit to working with what Representative Westrom and our testifiers to look at this issue in particular and any of the others that he might know specifically of to see if we can't resolve some of these issues without legislation?
Madam Chair, yeah. And certainly this issue on Lake Sylvia seems very unique. There may be a solution there.
Representative Dixon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate what you're trying to do, moving this specific issue forward, but the larger issue still remains. You know. We're not talking about use. We're not talking about transferring conditional use permits through change of ownership. Right? It's nothing like that. Now, Mr. Lacusmo, you know, mentioned that this land could be sold to a buyer and the buyer not even be aware that it's a non-conforming lot and they can't build on it. Well, it isn't government's job to babysit a purchaser. I think if you're going to put out that kind of money, you're going to find out what you can and can't do on the property. And so I find that argument a little hollow. Yes, I understand government would like them all combined to get the bigger lots, but to take away property rights to do that, I think is quite a stretch. So I still, while I understand trying to move this issue forward, particularly when you've got, you know, looks like maybe six rocks touching each other, all right? And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. The larger issue still remains, all right? When people purchase property and they purchase it under good faith, all right, can government change the rules on them in the middle of the game?
Either of you want to make a comment about that? Okay. All right, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record. How many, if I could just see a hand, how many more want to testify? Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Susan Buehler, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I do have to apologize. I'm coming to this a little bit uneducated since I have just sort of, I've just been tipped off to this particular issue. But what I am still, of course, concerned about and perplexed about is the questions that have been raised here, and as Representative Kemper has read that ordinance, there clearly isn't any language in there about relationship. It is about the lot. And what I'm perplexed here is why there's a prohibition when there is a relationship involved for the sale of the property. And so that's the issue I wanted to raise the concern for the committee. And also, I will just put for the record a clarification of the issue of disclosure of non-conforming lots. Currently in Minnesota, both real estate licensees as well as sellers of real property are required to disclose all material facts of which they are aware. Clearly, a non-conforming lot would be a material fact that would be required to be disclosed. So, and there is liability for sellers and licensees who fail to make material fact disclosures. So I just wanted to put that on the record as well. Representative Olson.
Thank you, ma'am. To that point, I was going to ask Mr. Lacasmal about the disclosure factor. Given what you just stated, why is it that it's not always being disclosed? Is it because the ordinance does not clearly state that it's an issue, that they won't be able to sell, or some other reason?
Go ahead. Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I can't answer the question as to why it's not being sold. My guess would be, if I would venture a guess, would be that they're not using a real estate agent when they're selling those lots, and many sellers are not familiar with the disclosure laws currently. So when they're selling them on their own. That would be my guess. But disclosure laws have been around for quite some time in Minnesota now. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, so, and forgive me, your name again?
Susan.
So from your base of knowledge and what you know, real estate agents do know that when they sell these lots, they have to inform the buyer, possible buyer, that they may not be able to resell this lot, or they won't be able to resell this lot. Because as you noted, in the ordinance, it's not specifically stated that the ownership is an issue.
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, definitely. If the real estate agent or the seller has knowledge of the potential use of that property or even intended use of the property, meaning somebody would want to build on that property. If they knew the prospective buyer had an intention of expanding or building on that property and they had knowledge of that, they absolutely would have to make a disclosure to that prospective buyer, both the seller as well as the licensee.
Madam Chair, thank you. To my point that I'm trying to raise with this question is the Susan, I didn't hear your last name.
Fiore.
Fiore, yes, thank you. I should remember that. Begging your pardon.
That's okay.
She said yes. It appears to me that there isn't knowledge out there required to be disclosed. Yes, if the real estate agent knows it, if they know it, then it is supposed to be disclosed, and I would assume that in most cases it is. But to Mr. Lacasmal's point about disclosure issues with this bill, we don't then have requirements that it's disclosed currently. And that reflects entrapment by the state in the respect that we know under our laws and ordinances that if it's sold to the same party that owns property next door, they won't be able to sell. And I think that's a real problem with the current law, and it actually reflects entrapment because you can see in our policies we're trying to eliminate these lots. And it really leaves me with a concern because I also see and consistently through a variety of departments from my experience with the zero discharge septic technology is they don't want to accept that technology, nor do they want to see it implemented. It wasn't even acknowledged here today after I talked about it. And that really concerns me because from the people that produce these, especially on a commercial level, and sell them to the state, the zero discharge septic technology equipment, when they sell it to the state, it's fine. When they sell it to an existing business, it's fine. But they won't sell it to a new business because they admit that they don't want rural development.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes, I was just going to comment, Madam Chair. Having bought and sold property a few times, on every purchase agreement that I've ever used, there's been statements about conforming with state and local laws regarding planning. And just any purchaser of property nowadays, it seems to me you have to do your own due diligence, and that is to go and contact your local zoning officials, which is relatively easy. And from the seller's side, you know, if there's an attorney or a real estate agent involved, they are obligated to disclose that, as Ms. Fiore indicated. I think the only way it occurs where you don't do it right is if you just go out and buy some property on the back of an envelope, excuse me, with some cash from somebody you know. I mean, I think that's the only way it actually occurs, where people don't have this information disclosed. And that's a pretty foolish thing to do in this day and age, it seems to me. So,
Madam Chair, to Representative Shumpert's point, imagine this situation. You have two non-conforming lots, one held by mom, one held by son. Mom dies, left to son. That son can never sell mom's property. Never. Because once it's in the same ownership, it cannot be sold. Now, by virtue of the fact that they were related, the value of that property diminishes hugely just because of the ownership component. Nothing changed with the property, nothing changed with the use, but by virtue of the fact that it's now under the same ownership, he'd never be able to sell off mom's property.
Representative
Shumpert. If that individual lived in the county that this zoning ordinance came from, he could combine his non-conforming lot with his mother's and sell them if they made a conforming lot. Correct? Or he could go...
That's correct, but son might want to keep his house and benefit from the value of his mother's estate and sell it. He can't do it.
Well,
let's go to the
chair. I'm sorry. I'm done. It's getting late. We've been here long enough.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Annalie Garlitz, and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties, along with the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, and we've had many discussions about this issue with DNR, with other units of local government, and particularly over the summer, we did sit down and talk about this. What we are finding that it's really coming down to is the local unit of government's ability to protect public health and make sure that in instances of shoreland lots, that the water quality is also being protected. There's a large list of things that the overall practice is trying to eliminate non-conforming lots, and rather than letting them perpetuate and continue on. Some of the concerns, the environmental concerns of this, and public health concerns are being able to allow for proper wastewater treatment, well protection, making sure that a septic system is located a proper distance from another well, water. There's ag land preservation instances where this comes into play. There's fire codes. There's stormwater things that need to be kept into perspective. There's minimum lot sizes, or because you need to keep in mind the impervious surfaces for as part of the DNR shoreline rules. You can only have a certain amount of impervious surface coverage on the lot. Shoreline protection, wetland protection, and other local ordinances that come into play to protect, again, the public health. For many years now, local units of government have been doing this method of the lot combination as part of carrying out the shoreline rules. And as Mr. Lacismo has noted, there's and as it's noted in the Wright County ordinance that's before you, there's different ways that counties have tried to be more flexible. And I do know that there's many counties, in addition to Wright County, who have tried to say, okay, you can be within 70 or 75% conformity for this, and we'll let you do this because we understand this. And as long as you can meet septic system requirements, impervious surface coverage, setbacks, okay, you can go ahead and build. But we do have lots of concerns about what this would do. The maps that Mr. Lacismo showed you were from Aitkin County, and I think they are on the lots that he indicated. It takes about 2 to 4 lots to come into even 75% conformity, and I do believe many of these are owned by the same individual. So we're really concerned about being able to have proper buildings, proper septic treatment, access to water, and setbacks to the lake on these lots. And I do know that this lake is actually also an impaired water, so that's another thing that local governments are taking into consideration.
Would you commit here in the interim to work with Mr. Lacismo and Mr. Westrum, Representative Westrum, to work on this issue? Because I do think that, you know, when it comes to family ownership, that this gets very messy.
It gets very messy, and you know, I do believe in philosophically in people's property rights. However, I do understand the need to, you know, I'm an environmentalist at heart, and so this is a very complicated issue. And I think that what Representative Weston, you've done a very good job by bringing this issue forward and continuing to have people talk about it. We're not going to vote on the bill today. We're going to lay it over. But I am going to hold those of you who came to testify to your word that you're going to work on this issue. And if I need to, I'm happy to go to a meeting or two during the interim with Representative Weston to make certain that people continue to work on this issue.
I just had a comment. It appears to me, I mean, if I were looking at this, and we don't see the legal description, so I'm not sure just what this all means, but it appears that it's an extremely narrow lot, and it looks like there's a 3-foot undefined, but it's measured all the way through, and it just seems to me that this parcel was bought to ensure lake access. Maybe that's a walking easement, or I don't know how it would be defined. We'd almost have to look at the language of the abstract. But there is a 3-foot section that runs down a third of this lot to get to the water's edge. So it seems to me that in the past someone purchased this to access the water, and maybe not to sell it as a lot. But certainly on Tract A, it doesn't appear to me, I could be wrong, that there's water easement on Tract A, but there is on Tract B, and that's what it looks like to me. And Tract A and Tract B could be probably combined so that then the owner of both parcels would have access to the water. I could be wrong, and maybe somebody could correct that, but you'd almost have to look at the language of the abstract rather than just this map. I think it's much more complex than what we're seeing here today.
Madam Chair, if I can just try to wrap things up, and I understand it's your prerogative. My concern with this is what I've heard for 4 years. Nothing happens, and if we don't put some teeth in it, the DNR hopes nothing happens. They're the ones that are causing this problem, partly. So if we as legislators are going to allow this takings to go on just because somebody's related, ultimately that's a policy decision. We say, okay, we agree with it. We think people should be taken advantage of, or if they're related, they should lose their investment or their retirement or whatever it is. To narrow this bill back to all this discussion that's going on from the realtors, which I'm surprised the realtors have this position, but that's insightful to me. Because my local realtors don't share the same view, but it's all about ownership. It isn't about the septic system. It isn't about other ordinances that they need to comply with. The issue still is, if person A and person B own these two parcels, Representative Scalzi, on this map, person A and person B, two different people, not related, own those two parcels that at one time were legal, non-conforming parcels. They can do whatever they want. They can sell it even as a tent lot. Under this rule, because of ownership, related ownership, that's the sole reason. All those other issues are nice to talk about, but don't get sidetracked with all the issues that the opponents brought up, which virtually didn't relate to this issue. This is only ownership issue. It isn't the thousands of legal non-conforming lots that the DNR tried to lead you to believe. It isn't about the legal non-conforming lots. It's about whether the person of ownership should be penalized severely because they're related to the person that owns the next lot next door. Now, from a legal standpoint, what would happen is person A comes into my office, I would say, you better set up an LLC, Joe's property, buy this parcel, set up another LLC that says Jane's property, you buy this parcel, and now you can do what you want to do and save your value of your investment or save your ability to sell this property separately. But if it's going to be under the same person of ownership, they can't do that. That's what this issue is about. So it probably won't get done again, Madam Chair. I'm skeptical of the system. I've heard this for 4 years, but I hope this will change it with your involvement. But Representative
Westrum, I have never told you that I would be involved in the last 4 years, but I do give you my word that I will be involved in whatever level you would like me to be involved. I am sympathetic to the ownership piece and having two people with the same name who happen to own the same property, but I also am sympathetic to developers who do come in, or one particular person who comes in and buys up a whole bunch of properties with the intent of not bringing them into conformity. You know, we have that not only along Lakeshore property, but you have that in a suburban area that needs to be redeveloped. You have all sorts of issues that come up as well. And so while I personally have experienced issues in a city that we tried to do redevelopment in, of having too small a lots and those kinds of things, that you needed to actually find ways to combine lots, I just don't want to fix the problem with a hammer. I'd rather fix the problem that we need to fix. So with that, Representative Olson has a question, and then I am going to lay the bill over. So you'll be the final question, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm going to change my comments because I think the state is, and the local governments are very wrong in this. I think we've done great harm, and we have a responsibility to do something about it. And I'd like to propose to you, hold the bill over, that's fine, as long as we genuinely are going to work on it. But I believe what should come out of this committee is an absolute statutory requirement that, whether it be on the deeds of these properties, somehow it's mandated by law that the information is given to the proposed buyer, not through the realtor, but it's given to the proposed buyer. The DNR, the county, has a responsibility to not allow a sale that can occur to entrap a buyer from not being able to sell this property later. So they are informed. We have that responsibility because we are discriminating and we're violating people's rights.
If you introduce a bill like that, Representative Olson, I will give it a hearing.
Madam Chair, we can do it on the floor. We could amend this bill now and pass it out. We have enough information. We don't need to delay this another year. I've heard every testifier that comes up against this bill not being willing to recognize how revolutionary the septic technology has come to, where it's come to. We passed it in 2003. It is pollution-free. You don't even need a well today. There's houses in this state without a well. They separate the waste, they recycle their water, and they've been doing it for years. The advancements in septic technology for commercial level or city level.
Representative Olson, I don't want to debate septic. I want to leave the minutes. I want to lay the bill over. So if you want to wrap up your comments, you've got about another minute and a half.
Madam Chair, I'm only trying to point out that we aren't accepting the technology that solves some of the problems that they say is behind this bill. We aren't willing to receive it. And it's practically a place where it's putting the city systems obsolete, making them obsolete. And I'm an environmentalist at heart. That's why I pushed it for 8 years. So we passed it. So I think we're making a grave mistake. I think we need to look at this, and I hope you'll support me on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Olson. With that, thank you, Representative Westrum. I'm going to lay the bill over. All right, I do need a motion on the minute. Representative Coonan will move the minutes of March 12th. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair, I was just handed an oath and informed that the Senate sent House File 3890 as the companion to the consent calendar. And I would respectfully request if we would be willing to do the same here instead of sending this to General Register.
And which bill was that? That was Representative Finstead's bill?
That's correct.
Is there any objection from the members for reconsideration to send it to the consent calendar? All right. I will move then that Representative Lanning moves that House File 3890 be reconsidered. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Lanning moves that House File 3890 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. We're adjourned.